Well, I haven't looked at that number, that tracking number, since I sent it to you, but I'll have to pull it up and see what it says. I was thinking it might meant that it was delivered to UPS, and now they can do their delivery. But they did pick it up, and it was late in the day today when they picked it up, too. I was wondering if he was going to come by, but he finally did. My wife had some other stuff that UPS had to come out and pick up, and so I just put that with it. And that's one of the options that they let you pick on the website is, you know, have it picked up with other stuff you're having picked up. So that worked out pretty good because she had already had stuff ready to go. So hopefully they delivered to them, and now they'll deliver it to you. Hopefully it doesn't come back to me, boomerang. But, I've done that same thing. Take it apart and put it back together, and it works. In fact, I did that just over the weekend. I put an NVMe drive in a computer, and the mSATA quit working. I took the mSATA out, put the NVMe, and it was working. Then I put the mSATA back in, and it wouldn't work. And then I took the NVMe out and put it back in, and then now everything works. So who knows? Goblins in there, ghosts and goblins, or probably just some oxidation or a fingerprint. Who knows what's going on inside there? But the main thing is you got it working again. Hope it's a decent card. I don't know that much about it. I think it was in its day, but I think its day is come and gone. But still, when it comes to crunching the gravitational waves, those things crunch pretty easy. So you can get a lot of them, right? And a graphics card is like 100 times to 300 times better than a CPU. So because they're easy to crunch and you've got like 100 to 300 times more crunching power, you can rack up a lot of credits that way and knock out a lot of work units. You can do in a week what would take a normal computer about a year to do. And that's the thing. If it didn't get it to you, it would just be sitting here doing nothing. So I'd rather see it go to work than just sit around collecting dust.
Tracking number, it said it was delivered, and it said it was, here's the tracking number, let's see what happens. But it's funny, because I've had UPS do that before. Yeah, tracking number, that number, wait a minute. It said delivered today at 3:58 p.m. to Greer, South Carolina. And it says it was signed for or left on the doorstep or a step or something. Okay. Shipped from Greer, delivery to Gray Court. Okay, maybe they put it back in the system. I've never cared for UPS. I've had things arrive kind of in smashed up condition. Oh, I had some kind of, it was a rifle, part of a rifle, this thick metal housing, like out of milled metal, and it was smashed. And I don't know what UPS did to it, but if they could smash the metal housing of like a rifle or a carbine, you know, that takes a lot of incompetence. But, no, those graphics cards, what are they? They're like vector processors. What is it, single instruction, multiple data? So it's like, multiply this number by these 100 numbers and, you know, do it all in one shot. That's why they're good for that, because that's the sort of thing graphics usually does. You know, take all these points and move them.
Okay, Glenn, I'm not sure if you're still there or not, but you were talking, and it just cut off right in the middle of your sentence. Might have had a battery that went dead. If so, I'll talk a little while, give you time to get the battery changed out. But you said you were talking about when it went out. You were talking about take this one thing and do these 100 things to it. Yeah, that is the science behind the graphics card that makes them so very, very fast. And the more cores you got, the more they can do it. And they are doing so little work, they can do it even faster. Programming is a science with those things. I haven't done any graphics card programming, but I have looked at their compilers to see how they work. And it is, it's no wonder that they lend themselves to neuro networking, because that's the way your brain works. One shot gets fired and it gets echoed by everything in your brain simultaneously. It's not like a CPU that does everything in a linear fashion. Anyway, let's see if you got back on the air. Back to you, KD2BNG, W4DJW in the Blue Ridge 2-meter net.
Has been even for 5 seconds here. I think if you pull the battery too low for too long. But yeah, you know, thanks for that, and I'll do something useful with that. And, now, Echolink versus IRLP, is there a radio, is there an RF interface? Because IRLP used to be, you know, you dial a few digits to access the IRLP, then dial in the node you want to talk to. But now Echolink has no radio interface, it's just a computer or a smartphone as an interface.
Now, you can do that, too. You can do that on, that's a very little used or maybe little known about feature of Echolink. And when you, for example, when you get one of those TMV71As that Kenwood says Echolink ready, that's what they're talking about. And what you can do, it's got like 10 slots, and you can plug in 10 node numbers. And if you're within shot of a repeater that is connected to Echolink and you're out mobile and you don't have a cell phone, then you don't need a cell phone. You just pull up one of those numbers and punch it in. It keys up. It sends those digits out. And that gives Echolink instructions to connect to another repeater or another node or another link or another conference. You can connect any of those conferences, repeaters, a simplex link, or just a node, another person. You can go person to person that way. And I've done that before. When I was out and about, I had Steve, KB0KBJ, I had his Echolink node plugged into my radio. And I just dial it up and punch the button. It would send out the DTMF to the repeater. The repeater would connect to the Echolink node, send that to the Echolink server, and the Echolink server would dial up Steve's cell phone or a repeater around him that had Echolink on it, whatever node number you used, and you'd be connected if he was there on the other end. It'll connect you. And then when you're finished with your QSO, you just send in a pound sign. Some of them take a pound, some of them take a star, or some of them take 7-3, right? 7-3, goodbye. And they drop the link when you send that in. So that's a feature that Echolink has, just like IRLP, works the same way. Different implementations of Echolink have different implementations. This one, this repeater, you just put in the node number and hit a pound at the end, and it'll go and connect to that link. Now you gotta be careful. If you connect repeater to repeater, then you have the potential to get into an infinite loop. Because what will happen is, you'll talk, and it'll come out on their repeater, and then it drops, and then it comes up with the courtesy tone at the end of the QSO. Well, that comes back to the other repeater, and it hears that, so it keys up. But the courtesy tone is gone, so it drops, and its courtesy tone goes out. And that sends that courtesy tone up to the other repeater, and then that repeater does a courtesy tone, sends it back to this repeater, and then this one does it, and they get in this infinite loop of doing courtesy tone. So you have to be careful when you connect to another repeater, and you have to be able to recognize that's what's going on and disconnect when it gets into that state. Does that make sense?
Echolink still does work that way. Because IRLP, which I guess is the older protocol, it's like key the mic, DTMF to tell the repeater I want IRLP node, and then DTMF the IRLP node, and then you're connected to some repeater in Switzerland or something.
That is the same way Echolink works. And the implementation on this repeater is you just put in the node number and hit a pound. And then when you want to disconnect, you just hit another pound, and it disconnects. And it works pretty good. Now, different radio manufacturers have different implementations of the two tones that are used to make a DTMF tone. DTMF is composed of two tones, and they're twisted. And some of them do a better twist than others, so sometimes you have to try more than once to get it to work. I found some Kenwood to Kenwood implementations didn't work, whereas Yaesu to Kenwood worked, Icom to Kenwood worked, but Kenwood to Kenwood didn't work, so go figure.
It's usually very, very reliable, but yeah, the DTMF tones can be funny. And I forget who you were talking to about that, but, you know, it's actually, it's rare nowadays, except for, like, the very elderly of us that I have no internet at all. You know, that's kind of unusual. But around here, I'm starting to find out it's not that unusual, at least not, like, high-speed broadband internet. And I guess it depends where you are. I could go within a mile of here and find somewhere where you can't get broadband.
W4DJW and the Blue Ridge 2-meter net. Well, that's what those big companies like Facebook and I guess it's Google and Apple are wanting to. They're experimenting with different ways to make internet access free to everybody, right? Just like the air that you breathe. Hope they're successful, but that's a pretty big goal, pretty big ambitious goal. But who knows? They've got airplanes that fly 24/7 by 365, and they get all their energy from the sun. They've got cell packs up there on the wings, and they've got huge wingspans, and they fly really slow, and they just go around in big circles, and they, you know, that's line of sight, and line of sight at 2 gigahertz will go a long way.
Gee, I had always thought in an area like this to make some sort of rural internet cooperative. In other words, let's say I'm on a street that has internet and the side road doesn't. If I could run a bunch of Wi-Fi extenders down that street, people down that street, you know, that dirt road could get internet and somehow make that some cooperative arrangement where everyone's sharing the cost. You know, the people who have internet who are willing to share it and the others who are willing to buy the equipment and kick back money to those who have it. But your contract with your ISP may not allow that.
Yeah, that's taking money out of the pockets of the internet service providers until it's free for everybody. Let me check to see if there's any other stations. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net? Call W4DHAW. Okay, they're not here yet. I'm trying to get two more. If we get two more, we'll hit 50. Back to you, KD2BNG, W4DHAW.
KD2BNG. Yeah, well, too bloody bad. The ISPs are making too much money as it is. I'm paying $70 a month just for internet. No other service is what I'm paying Charter. I want to run something here that's going to waste a lot of bandwidth. Maybe I'll set up a Tor node. They're not going to like that. Oh, you have 200 megabits of downstream speed. Yeah, well, for what you're charging me, I'm going to find something to do with it.
Well, it's quite competitive now, right? And that's a good thing. There's a lot of service providers out there, so you've got a lot of options. And I heard AT&T is now going to be running fiber optics. So with the replacement for the cable, it used to be Charter. Now it's, I can't remember what it is. Starts with an S. Anyway, now they've got their work cut out for them. So each one ups the other and reduces the price and we benefit. But, you know, in the beginning when the technology is kind of new, the early adopters that pay the big bills, and then everything starts coming down after that.
That's who I wanted to say. Yeah, Charter is now Spectrum. But no, I don't know. Actually know if I have any meaningful competition in this area. I could go to Piedmont Regional Telephone and I could get DSL. That's not going to be any better. Probably a whole lot worse, and it's going to cost about the same. So no, in a lot of cases, for the last mile of connection, you know, you really don't have competition, unfortunately, in most places. What else can I do is I can do fixed wireless, 3G or 4G, whatever you got, or satellite, you know, forget about that. That's not useful. Expensive and slow and, you know, works lousy. I've had it before. But, yeah, no, I tend to disagree. I don't think there is competition for the last mile.
Well, if you look at the coverage maps, if you go look at the big providers for cellular anyway, or Verizon and AT&T, they've got a lot of coverage. And I don't know. I haven't looked at the map since they beefed them up since COVID. But I imagine with a Yagi or a pair of Yagis or four Yagis, you could probably hit a cell tower from a pretty long way away if you can get some altitude on it. I was playing around with two Yagis, twin Yagis on the cellular bands, and getting a signal here full strength with those two Yagis, whereas with nothing and the cell phone all by itself, nothing, absolutely nothing, no signal whatsoever. Put a pair of Yagis up, and I got full signal strength, 5 bars.
Really, do what I used to do sometimes in the past is somebody else's Wi-Fi. That's why I'm not especially fond of Wi-Fi. These are all wired connections to all these machines. I've got Ethernet cable running everywhere, except for the iPhones. That's the only wireless connection. Yeah, you know, I guess Spectrum, for what they charge, you know, it started at $30 a month, then it went to $50, $55, $60, now it's $70, and I have no other services. So I don't, you know, there needs to be meaningful competition, as, you know, like, another cable company has to come in, but I guess that's not allowed. For two cable companies to serve the same area, you know, it should be allowed. You're talking about competition, but this is anti-competitive.
Well, you usually have to go that way a little while until the competition gets there. But hopefully these guys that are working on free internet for everybody makes some headway, and then their bubble will be bursted. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there, Glenn. Well, I better move on. I'm going to see if Ray's still here. He might not hang around too much longer. You got anything else for us this evening?
That was my entire list of topics. No, go ahead and see who else is out there. I'm sure I've used up my verbiage for tonight. So I'll probably talk to you later, K82BG.
Okay, Glenn, and I did pull up that tracking number, and you're right. It says it was delivered to my house about the same time they picked it up from my house, so somebody got something wrong somewhere. It happens. Anyway, appreciate you hanging around for the Rag Chew portion of that this evening. Hope that thing crunches some numbers for you. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net, call W4DJW. Okay, looks like I'm going to have to settle for 48. Let's see if Ray hung around. K4SUG, are you still there? Call W4DJW in the Blue Ridge 2-meter net.
Fixing to go in and get me a cup of coffee here shortly. So you timed it just about right. We had a pretty reasonably good day today. I had been having some problems with the gate opener on my upper gate. Give you an idea how a dummy can get himself in trouble. I kept working with that thing, and I go back to the troubleshooting guide, said it was in the motor circuit. I went through the motor circuit two or three or four times, and they couldn't find anything at all wrong with it. All of a sudden, it dawned on me, the battery's in the motor circuit too, Dave, over.
It's the simple things, right? We want to try to make it. I said somebody that at work today. We want to make it more difficult than it is, but it's not that difficult sometimes. Yeah, I know what you mean. That's when you palm your forehead with the palm of your hand and say, "Why didn't I think of that earlier? Why didn't I think of that 4 hours ago?"
You're always trying to make a simple problem, make something complicated out of a simple problem. That's usually what happens. You can't be satisfied with something that's obvious and just stands out and hits you between the eyes and still can't get your attention. Well, I got the had another project. My lawnmower got so it was running for about, a couple of loops around the yard and quit. I'd nurse it around, get it started again, a couple of loops around the yard and quit. So I decided I'd find out what was wrong with it. And I found somehow or other it had a couple of leaves that got in the gas tank. Now, I'm not going to blame it on great-granddaughters, but you use your own judgment. Anyway, I got the leaves out, but there's still a little bit of trash left in it, and I'm still having problems. And to top that all off, I had one side of the muffler loosened up, and it was pumping hot exhaust gas up on that gas filter. So I had two problems. I had a partially stopped up gas line and a vapor lock on top of it. So I got that straightened out today. I took the whole thing apart, blew the lines out good, put a new filter on it, dressed it back away from the engine, tightened up that bolt in the exhaust pipe. Lo and behold, it runs now, Dave.
Well, I'm glad to hear you got it going again. The vapor lock thing can be hard to hard to figure out sometimes. You can't see inside that gas line. It's hard to figure that one out. It reminds me of the first car that I ever had. It was a 65 Mustang. And I bought it, in Easley, and I drove it home. No, I didn't drive it home. My mom drove it home from Easley to Taylor's. And then my sister drove it somewhere. And I guess it had a lot of miles on it or something. But anyway, those valve guide seals, the seal that sits over the top of the valve and doesn't let oil go down into the crankcase, into the firing combustion chamber, had hardened and they got brittle and they broke up and they fell down in the oil pan. And after a while, there was enough of them down there in the oil pan that one of them made its way into the oil pump. And it got in there in between the gears and locked the gears up. And that twisted the drive shaft to the distributor into, right? That just, because it locked up, but the gear, the drive gear was still turning off of the camshaft. And it just rung that little hex drive shaft. It's just, it looks like, it's about the size of a pencil. It looks like a pencil. And it just twisted that thing right into. Well, it took me a while to dig into it to find that. And one of the things my uncle suggested was that I put a short block from J.C. Whitney in there. Well, it took me about 6 months to save the money. This is a new car to me. I just got it. It was my first car ever. And it was sitting up on jack stands with the engine all torn apart for 6 months. And didn't have much gas in it when I parked it. And saved the money, got a J.C. Whitney short block, and rebuilt the whole engine. That's when I first met Doc Green up there in Traveler's Rest, because he did all my head work and everything. Rebuilt the heads that went back on the short block. And I was out there trying to start that thing up after I got it all put back together, all painted pretty, looked really good, smelled like paint, you know. And I'm cranking on that thing and cranking on that thing, cranking on that thing. I couldn't get it to start. And I checked the firing order, and then I checked the location of the number one at top dead center on the firing stroke. And where the distributor shaft was pointed, my dad came out there. He took the gas cap off of the back. He got tired of hearing me cranking that engine over. So he came out there. He took the gas cap off. He moved the car around side to side and stuck his ear down there to it. And he said, "I don't hear nothing." And I went back there. This shook the car, stuck my ear down there, and said, "I don't hear nothing either." There was no gas in it, right? That thing wasn't going to start till I put gas in it.
To complicate matters, I tried to make a run on air before, Dave, but I never had too much success. Well, we had an old car. It was bad about vapor locking. We carried a gallon jug in the trunk of the car full of water. As long as you're running, you're doing fine, but you pull up, you know, on a hot day, you pull up and park somewhere and let it sit there for a little bit. She wouldn't start. So you get the jug out, and you pour the water over the fuel pump, and then wind it up, and then take off, and you go again until the next time. they get interested when you start moving with stuff like this. I've moved my hair out more than one over a simple problem that I should have spotted when I first opened the hood on the thing. And work and work and work. But you tend to overlook the simple things. That's the main thing. You stop. Get yourself a cup of coffee or whatever and get your brain in gear, and you'll be a whole lot better off over it.
You know, there's a lot of truth to that, Ray. There's a lot of times I'd be working on an equation when I worked at Michelin, trying to get a curve to come out a certain way for doing the sidewall of a tire, like Mr. Bibb, right? Like try to get his thumb in the right location, and the tool would take off and go the wrong way. And I'd look at that thing, and I'd look at that, I'd say, I know that's got the center of the radius is over here, and the arc length is this, and that. And I just sometimes my boss would say, go home, sleep on it. When you come back tomorrow morning, you'll have it solved in the first 10 minutes. And you know what? He was right. He was very, very right. By the end of the day, your brain just stops working. It just refuses.
Wild story, and then I'll let you go, Dave, because it's getting late. My first automobile was a 1936 Chevrolet Standard, and my sister gave it to me for a graduation present. And it wasn't in too good a shape, so my dad decided he'd buy me a short block and bought it from Montgomery and Ward's for all places. Well, he bought one, they brought it out there, he opened the case on it, looked at it, and take it back. They took it back, and he went down to the store and looked through it, and they opened the crates on about three. They don't want that one, don't want that one. This one will be fine. And I found out later on what he was doing. He's checking the size of the pistons. These are all rebuilt blocks. And the first ones he looked at had different size pistons in all the holes. So he found and found one that had standard pistons all the way through, and that's the one he bought. So we got it home, and we didn't have a chain ball or anything like that. We hoisted the old one out with a piece of pipe and a chain, and him on one end of the pipe, me on the other, and hoisted the new one in the same way. Well, I was underneath hooking up, putting the transmission in was buckled. I was doing it that particular instant. And I was working down there, just slaving away. He looked down at me and said, now don't ring it off. He shouldn't have said that. I was about to sign it. He got it out of his mouth. That boat was popped. He didn't say a word. He picked up his tools that he was using to picked up a rag, wiped them all off nice and clean and shiny, put it back in the toolbox, started up the steps, turned around, looked at me, and said, call me when you get it out.
So, Ray, that's a lesson that you, because that's hard. That's pretty tough sometimes to get that thing flat and center punched and center drilled and an easy out to get in there and to back that thing out. That can take hours. So that's a pretty good way to learn a lesson, not to over-tighten it. My cousin did that to me one time. I was putting the nuts on where the torque converter went into the flywheel, and I asked him, what's the torque on that? And he went and got the Chilton's manual. And he said 90 foot-pounds. And I said, are you sure these aren't that big? Right? They were like a 9/16 bolt. 90 foot-pounds on a 9/16 bolt? And he said, they're fine threaded, 90 foot-pounds. And my cousin liked to play tricks on me all the time. So I start cranking on that thing with a torque wrench, and way before it got to 90 foot-pounds, it broke that thing off. And, you know, those things are welded on the torque converter, so I had a time. I believe I had to go get it. I don't remember how I solved that, but yeah, those are hard learned lessons, Ray.
If somebody tells you to do something and it don't sound right, you question him and he tells you the same thing again, put your wrenches down, go get the book and look at it for yourself, Dave.
That is absolutely the truth. Another thing he did was back in the days when you had points and under the distributor cap, is he'd get a pencil and he'd open the points up and he'd write on the contact surface with the lead pencil, try to start a car after you're doing that. It will not start. And the only thing you have to do to clean it is pop open those points, put a dollar bill in between them, and drag the dollar bill all the way out. It'll start right up right after that.
That paper cleaning job is not necessarily with a dollar bill, but just a piece of typewriter paper, so cleaning points and cleaning contacts over various other circuits besides the points in an automobile. Works good, Dave.
Those are lessons you learn that you don't ever forget, Ray. When you learn them the hard way like that, those are good lessons, I guess. I guess my cousin, as much as a jokester as he was, he did teach me some hard lessons, like somebody tells you 90 foot-pounds on a 9/16 bolt, don't believe what they said.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, I had a little bit of formal education on all those mechanics. I worked with my brother-in-law in his shop. Well, I worked on my own old car. If I hadn't been able to fix it myself, it wouldn't have got fixed, and I'd been walking. But anyway, I worked with him in his shop and learned a little bit there. And then I went in the Army, and I signed up for the USAFE course. You know what that is, I think. It's the automobile mechanics course that you can get through the military, and it's just book work. You don't have any hands-on stuff, but you can read the book and you can get an idea of how things work and why they do, why they don't, when they don't work, and that helped me a whole lot. But the experience that you get on working on things, I'd say at least 50% of the troubles you learn to look for and helps you to solve your problems are troubles you found the hard way. They're not in the book, over.
Well, that's very true. Yeah, I did go to formal training like you did, too, out at Greenville Tech. They had an automotive repair class, and I went and took it. And I'm telling you, I thought I knew a lot before I took that class, because I'd been working on cars since I was 14. I had my driver's license when I was 14, and I got that Mustang when I was 14, and I learned a lot on that thing. I took it all the way apart and put it all the way back together, including the transmission. My dad and I up underneath of it, him on one end of the broom handle, me on the other, lifting that transmission up into the back of that thing. But when I took those classes out at Greenville Tech, and they started explaining to me how the brake calipers worked and how a battery worked, and they took us out to a battery shop and showed us how batteries were manufactured, I did learn a lot that I wouldn't have learned doing it on my own. And it did make a difference. And they did teach me some tips and tricks. So they passed along what they had learned to me, so I didn't have to learn it again. I didn't have to learn it on my own, which did accelerate my learning a little bit. But like you said, busted knuckles in the middle of the winter when it's raining and you're laying on your back and water running down your shirt collar, those are learning experiences you will not forget.
And you start trying to start a bolt or unscrew a nut, and the weather, the temperature is cold, your hands are cold, and you keep turning and turning and turning, and nothing comes out. You look down and you pull the hide off of your fingers because you ain't turning the bolt. You slide your frozen fingers around the outside of it. I've done that a few times too. Dave, I better let you go. I think we could keep it up half the night with these wild stories. And see, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction. They showed me that all my life, and I have lately begun to believe that. If it's true and you can prove the point, a lot of times that's the strangest story you can ever have to tell over.
Yeah, you hear that a lot. Mother Nature has a wilder imagination than we'll ever have. I like to read stories about the cosmos and what's going on out there in the universe with nature out in the universe, and it's pretty wild, Ray. I watched a video the other day about what things start to happen as you approach the speed of light. And it's just somebody thinking really deep and long about it for a long time, and then relaying to you what they think would happen. And this gets pretty wild. The Doppler effect on light, things that are in front of you get brighter because you're absorbing more protons. Things behind you get darker because you're outrunning the protons. Or you're not outrunning them, but you're approaching the speed of light, so it takes them longer to get to you. Little things like that, little nuances, yeah. Nature has a pretty wild imagination.
I used to get a thrill out of listening to Wayne Hollins and your father when they argue the point about parallel lines, whether parallel lines come together or not in the distance. And they would spend hours on that subject. You just wouldn't believe how much time they spend arguing the point on parallel lines. And both of them come up with some pretty good arguments, too. But the fact remains that parallel lines do not come together. They should not be collusion over.
Yeah, you could say by definition, the definition of the parallel lines of the space between them. You could pull the by definition trick out of that. But then my dad asked me the same thing. He asked me and my sister, do parallel lines ever intersect? And I was really quick. I said, no. The definition of parallel lines is that they don't intersect. He said, okay, so what happens to the point where they cross two lines and then you rotate them until they become parallel? What happened to the intersection point? Where'd it go? And I heard a scientist explain something similar to that, what is a singularity? So what happens to those two lines as they go from crossed? What happens to that intersection point as they go from crossed to parallel? And what we call that is it went to infinity. Well, what is infinity? Well, it's the same thing as a singularity. Well, what's a singularity? I heard a scientist give us the definition of a singularity. And it's real simple, Ray. We don't know. That's it. We don't know.
Andrew, Dave, you had yourself a good night. I've enjoyed it, and I'm not going to hold you up any longer. It's getting late, and I know you probably did. You've been sitting here since 9 o'clock. You're probably getting tired, so you have yourself a good night and a good day tomorrow, and I'll try to kick in with whoever gets on here tomorrow night. I don't know who it'll be. And, I understand you took the net manager job. I appreciate that, Dave, and I hope you have as much luck with it as I did. It's where you did.
Okay, Ray. Well, we do appreciate you hanging around for the Rag Chew portion of the net. It's been a while since we had a talk like that. Yeah, we used to go to 1 o'clock in the morning. Those days are gone. Anyway, Ray, always enjoy it. Appreciate you being here this evening. You take care. You and Miss Edie stay safe. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net called W4DJW? Go ahead.
DJW, KK4FTU. Just a quick observation I found. Somebody showed me. I know you and Ray both would get a kick out of this. Look on YouTube at a guy named Mike Patey, Papa Alpha Tango Echo Yankee, and look at some of his designs on the aircraft. He built one that, called Scrappy, and it's pretty interesting.
I'll have to look that up. That does sound... I like airplanes. Ray likes airplanes, too. So we'll have to look that one up. Appreciate the tip.
It's a bush plane that's got 20 inches of wheel travel for the main landing gear on a Cub-style airplane.
Have you seen those land going backwards? Those Alaskan bush pilots, have you seen any of them? They can land on those big balloon tires with the 20-inch travel. They can land those things in reverse.
He won a couple of awards for takeoff. He put a 650-horsepower engine on one of them for a short takeoff and landing. I think one of the records is like landing in 9 feet.
Yeah, or landing with your wheels rolling backwards. If you get enough headwind with those Piper Cubs, I think there's another one too. I can't remember what the name of it was. But the planes that they used up there in the Alaskan bush, if you get enough headwind, they can fly slower than the headwind is coming at them. So they're actually going backwards when their wheels come down to the ground. they're flying forward in the wind, but they're going backwards on the ground. So it would be a negative distance landing. Instead of positive 9 feet, they'd land going backwards, negative 9 feet.
Well, some of his YouTube videos, he's got some really interesting stuff he's done. I think both you and Ray will find it interesting. I don't want to tie you up anymore because I know you're tired after working all day and then having a good net. So I'll leave it with you, W4DJW and Annette, KK4FTU.
Well, we appreciate you throwing that in there. Oh, I can always talk about airplanes. Love them. Appreciate you hanging around for the rag portion of that. Have I missed anyone for check-ins, or have I missed any rag shoots called W4DJW? All right. Be sure and stop by tomorrow night where WD4CYM, Miss Karen, will be here to call the net. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it, and I'm sure she'd appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and send in my net report. This is W4DJW now securing the Blue Ridge 2-meter net with our thanks for checking in. We'll now return the repeater back to normal amateur use. 73s and good night.